Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. Today, I'm very pleased to have my friend Nathan Smith with me. Nathan, welcome.
Thanks, Jake. Nice
Absolute
to be here.
Pleasure. So, as I briefly touched on before we started, I'm very keen to learn about people's journeys to Bitcoin. And everyone's is unique. Everyone has a different lens, in a sense, on why they see value in it and why they decided to adopt it as their currency and become Bitcoiners. And yeah, I'd love to dig into your story. So perhaps just to kick us off, you could give us a brief overview as to what you're all about, the projects you're working on, and we'll dive in.
Yeah. So my main role in the Bitcoin space these days is with a company called fastbitcoins.com. The company is based in the UK, or actually the Isle of Man these days. I got the Australian business going, the processes that you have to go through to get registered down here. And then also took on the role of chief compliance officer for the company. So that's a global role. And under the Fast Bitcoins umbrella, we have another brand called Freehold Capital. So it's freehold.capital, the website there. And that's more focused on education and focused on institutions and individuals that need that sort of higher touch as they're getting into Bitcoin.
Well, and I do know a little about both Fast Bitcoins and Freehold, of course, from just our interactions. They both sound like really interesting businesses that are growing faster than probably you guys expected. But we'll dig into the details of that a little later. If we could rewind further back and go through perhaps, like, you know, what did you study at university, and what were you interested in as a teenager? You know, what were your first jobs like? And can you identify a time or a moment where actually Bitcoin suddenly made sense? I'm sure there's probably multiple. I like to think of, you know, lots of touch points where you go, oh, that's interesting. And then a year later, oh, that's really, really interesting. And then you might forget about it. And then it suddenly becomes like your entire focus, frankly.
It is amazing.
Perhaps really, really rewind back as far as you can go and talk me through how you might have experienced life or how you approach things.
Yeah, I grew up in a country town, a town called Moama, which is in New South Wales, but it's on the Murray River. It's actually the closest place in New South Wales to Melbourne. Quite a historic town. It had the largest inland port there back in the day. So lots of beautiful old buildings and you know, big sheep farms and the wool trade. The wool would be carried on barges down the river to Echuca, Moama, and be unloaded and then shipped in, you know, bullet trays or whatever down to Melbourne. So that was a beautiful place to grow up. My dad had a pharmacy there in town. I was very lucky with my dad. Like, I think he was a really good businessman, like not overly intellectual, but a really good businessman. And he and his business partner had that business for about 20 years. And that provided us with, you know, quite a comfortable upbringing looking back. You know, money was never a problem. We weren't like overly wealthy, but we had everything that we needed. And, you know, we lived a pretty comfortable sort of life. My mum was a nurse before she had children. And then she gave that up and raised three boys. So looking back from my perspective now, like that would have been a very big job. So that was a great upbringing. I got shipped off to boarding school at age 13 down to Melbourne. Had 4 years down here, which was a lot of fun. In terms of my interest in those days, I always tried to get, like, it was expected of us to get good marks. Like, you know, my parents were making sacrifices to pay boarding school fees and so forth. So there was a bit of a quid pro quo there. Tennis was my main sport that I played. I really, really loved that. And had some great mates, played at school and played at that club here in Melbourne as well. And other than that, mate, chasing girls and just being as awkward as hell as a teenager, trying to figure out how it all worked. That was a nice childhood looking back. I went off to uni. I studied civil engineering and law at Monash Uni. Kind of keeping my options open. I didn't really have a career path that was very obvious to me. So those two degrees are pretty general sort of degrees and can lead in lots of different directions. And that was a lot of fun being at uni. Like, obviously hard about exam time is pretty intense, but the social life side of things was great.
And, you make some incredible friends through your school and through university. It's definitely, it's funny when you think about it, how much time you spend going through those institutions. And really the most value is the friends rather than like what they teach you, which is the whole point of being there. So it's kind of that funny thing where, oh yeah, I'm going to university to get a degree, but I don't really care about the degree because it's really just about the people that you meet. Those are obviously then foundations for the future as well.
Yeah. And I think it's harder these days because the uni fees are a lot, lot higher. Mm. I think I was paying something like $1,200 a semester when I started. So it was hugely subsidized. So people would spend a long time there and they would, may not be that focused on their studies. Some people, eventually everyone got there, but it was a lot easier, I think, to have that kind of social side of things. Whereas now for kids coming through, I think there's a real question of, do you go to university or not?
Yeah.
Some professions you absolutely will have to, if you're going to become a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer, you need to have those sorts of qualifications. But, if you're going to do your gender studies or whatever and come out of it with $100,000 student debt.
What's the fucking point? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's an interesting one. My kids are reasonably academic, but I think there's still a question for them, like, do they go to university? Or the learning resources online these days are incredible.
Mm.
And it's just a question of, do you need that piece of paper to get you a job?
Well, and having just become a dad, it's not something that's ever really kind of crossed my path per se. But so Daniel Prince, I've been on his pod and he's joined Jigs and I and Matty on our other YouTube channel. And his view of school is so refreshing, and his opinion is very much like, it's about obedience and what a waste of fucking time. Homeschooling is the way forwards by miles, especially given all of the different tools that are there today. So certainly something I'm keen to learn a lot more about. And you raise the obvious point. It's like, well, why spend $100,000 on something that's potentially not worth it? Like it's right to ask the questions. And actually, you got to go to university and get a degree, don't say anything against that. Yet actually it's very rational to ask that question. And it's just really what this podcast is all about, to be honest, is asking questions. Like we should be able to ask questions in this world. We shouldn't be scared of challenging difficult topics or going off topic or off piste, frankly. A lot of things that we might say or do at the moment, people would be like, you can't say that, you can't do that. So, well, actually, Bitcoin's been built already. You may not care about it, but it doesn't care about you and it will affect your life. And university is perhaps a little similar like that. How interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so when you were doing these two degrees, I guess you, as you mentioned, you chose quite a generalist approach to your studying. And when you're looking to basically you're booted out of uni and you've got to start working. So talk a bit about that and how you tried to decide on the next steps you were going to make and where you ended up.
Yeah, I kind of gotten very interested, obsessed with financial markets in the last year of my uni. So trading and how did markets work, really went down that rabbit hole. And when I finished my uni, I saw advertised a job with Macquarie in Hong Kong. And I didn't know anything about investment banks, didn't even know what they were, but applied for that and turned out they wanted someone local Hong Konger for that role. But they had some other roles in Sydney that I was able to apply for and managed to secure something and, packed my bags and headed up to Sydney. And that was, I remember looking at myself in the mirror in a suit. It was just so weird after years of uni of, wearing jeans and tracksuit pants or whatever. I found it quite funny because it all happened pretty quickly. And so I was off to One Martin Place in Sydney, at the center of the financial center in Sydney.
Wow.
And that was an awesome journey. The training that you get at somewhere like Macquarie and the sort of standards they expect, it was a real, real help to me. Really great mentors there. Wasn't always easy, but I look back very fondly on my time there. I had 10 years in the end.
10 years.
Six in Sydney and then four in London.
Okay.
And met my wife there and still got some absolute great friends from those days. So,
wow.
I was really lucky.
So, I don't know much about Macquarie. So could you just teach me a bit about the business itself and what that ended up, you know, being like, what the atmosphere was like, and what were you trained? Like, how were they teaching you? What were they teaching you about? And yeah, just a bit of color on what life was like there.
Yeah. So it's a pretty big conglomerate, and certainly these days, probably famous for infrastructure investment, did a lot of pioneering in infrastructure investment, infrastructure funds around the world. Real estate was another big part of the business, and that was where I spent some time as well. And then trading businesses across all sorts of commodities, precious metals, equities, treasury markets, interest rate markets, you know, the full gamut of that sort of thing. And I think in recent times, I've kind of gotten more into retail banking and mortgages.
So okay.
Quite wide, yeah. And in terms of the training, I mean, there's a lot of focus on quantitative analysis and financial modeling and how you looked at all that sort of thing. And also a big focus on risk, you know, so you had to really articulate the many different risks that could be coming about as part of a transaction. And then, you know, you had to assess those and try and mitigate them. And the way that the company is set up is there's an independent risk management division that signs off on everything that any business wants to propose. So that was set up by the managing director, Alan Moss. And the idea was that it was sort of segregated out so that it was a way of overseeing what the businesses were doing, and that independent risk management division reported directly through to him as the managing director. So it was a good structure, and it certainly led to a lot of robust debate at times. And the approach really was, rather than from the risk management division, rather than try to stop transactions, try to think about, well, how could we do this? So the business comes along, no, that risk is unacceptable. How could we structure it? What could we change to make it acceptable, mitigate those risks and allow the transaction to proceed? So yeah, it was a very, yeah. And, you know, back in those days, capital was basically free, you know, had a banking license. You know, bank capital is quite a rubbery game, as you would know. So the business was tremendously profitable. And I did okay. Like, I think I did far better out of that than I would have in other places. And looking back, that was just a lucky thing to come into. But I was orders of magnitude off where the sort of rungs above me, you know, guys that had started, you know, 5 or 10 years earlier, perhaps. You know, some of those guys made a hell of a lot of money just from being employees of a bank. So, yeah, it was a really successful period. And then obviously the financial crisis happened in 2008 and 2009.
Yep.
And that really turned everything around. We were bailed out by the Reserve Bank of Australia, as all the Australian banks were. And we had other competitors such as Babcock and Brown, who didn't have a banking license. They went to the wall.
Wow.
And our business models were very, very similar. So it was just a lucky thing that Macquarie got through that.
Wow.
Thanks to a lot of money being printed and distributed to the right places. Yeah,
it's so amazing. I mean, essentially, an investment banking insider is 10 years with the business like that. You understand how it functions, the different characters, and it's often something that's in some senses like vilified in the normal press, and quite rightly so. You know, when you start digging into this whole concept of what a banking license is, you're like, well, hang on, what is that? And the regulatory framework that's been developed over time is very favorable to those with banking licenses. And ultimately, from my understanding, the taxpayer is basically the reserve bank of this type of business model. It's the best business model ever created, fractional reserve banking with banking licenses, creating your own money. And if it goes wrong, fuck it, get the taxpayer to bail you out. It's nuts. Perhaps you could go into that in a little more detail. Like, what does it mean to have a banking license, and how did that protect Macquarie in this instance versus the competitor that you mentioned?
Yeah. So, as an ADI, or authorized deposit taking institution, you have a license from the Reserve Bank. So you've got sort of a, you know, government license to operate. And, if your business gets to a point where it gets in trouble, such that those deposits could be at risk, what we've seen is that the RBA will print as much money as it needs to bail out those deposit holders and the business generally. And it's the same thing that's happened right through the history of central banking and banking. The bank goes along and says, look, this is going to crash the entire economy. You know, this is no time for prudence. We just need as much money printed as is needed to bail out the system, or the ATMs will stop working and there'll be riots on the street by Tuesday. It's the same sort of stuff that has happened. It happened around the world, as many, many Bitcoiners know. But yeah, you've just got that lifeline where you can privatize the profits and socialize the losses. And when you say taxpayer, I would suggest that it's the citizen, all citizens, because many citizens don't pay tax.
Yeah, or pay a different level of tax. Yes, fair call.
Yeah, but it's most of it is done through inflating the money supply. Mm. And that is a tax on everyone who uses that currency.
Yeah, okay, that's an important definition then. So taxpayer is perhaps my mainstream media kind of article regurgitating itself about, like, you know, these devil bankers and how the taxpayers, you know, are going to have to bail them out. And actually that's bullshit, right? It's the money printing affects everyone.
It's sort of right, but I'm trying to push back on it.
Stealth. No, it's a great point. No, thank you for clarifying. Okay. And so you mentioned you did 10 years with Macquarie. So when did that period finish up, and what happened in between finishing that and maybe finding Bitcoin or finding yourself working and building a Bitcoin exchange here in Australia?
Yeah, well, Esther and I were keen to get back to Australia. We had a 2-year-old lass at that point, and the quality of life was going to be better in Australia. The game had sort of changed in terms of banking. It was just harder to make money, and it was the opportunities just weren't there the way they were earlier. So I think it was October 2009, I managed to get out, and that was a good process. And we did a little bit of traveling, came back to Australia. And in that time, I've worked with a couple of Melbourne family offices and their property businesses, which was really, really interesting to sort of get an insight into some of the high net worth community in Melbourne, and just work for smaller businesses. So that was enjoyable. And then after that, we did some family startups. So we have a couple of businesses under that umbrella. They're managed out of the UK by my brother. We run the businesses in Australia as well. So the main one is a patented thermal heat pack called Hotties. So it's just like a microwavable heat pack. It's safe, and it's not like the sort of gels or wicks that can be quite dangerous and overheat and burn people. So that business ticks along. And then 2019, I was introduced to Danny Brewster, who's the founder, mm-hmm. co-founder and the managing director of Fast Bitcoins, introduced by Stefan. And we had a really good discussion. Danny was keen to set up down in Australia. I've been working with the team ever since, setting that up and operating it, and then contributing to some of the global initiatives as well.
Awesome. So at some point in there, you must have bought Bitcoin for the first time.
When
was that? And how can you describe that process? And if you can, draw it back to, you know, you were a risk analyst at points through your Macquarie career. So, you know, if you were going to propose a piece of business and you couldn't get it through your risk department, then it wasn't going to happen. How does someone with that kind of training view a neutral cryptocurrency that's in its infancy like this? And what I love about this is I like leveraging other people's skill sets to my own benefit. It's self-interest driven, but it's something I've learned that, you know, when you can't cheat, you know, you can't look at someone's exam paper in the classroom. Well, in investing, that's bullshit. If you find someone who you trust, who has great insights and they've done the due diligence, then it's absolutely okay to leverage their experience and conviction. So how does someone like yourself, that is, you know, clearly you've got a legal background, great at analyzing risk, suddenly come across this this nascent technology and get involved?
Yeah, I think I first got interested watching some of the Real Vision interviews. I don't subscribe to Real Vision anymore, but I did at that time. And there was a great interview with Wences Casares,
mm-hmm.
who's an early Bitcoin legend. And really the thing that struck me about it was the asymmetry. So I'd always been interested in asymmetric trades where your downside is very capped, but the potential for upside is there. And Wences made a comment that if Bitcoin works, it could be valued at $1 million a coin. This is when it's trading at maybe $500. So that was really interesting. I could see that. And that kind of got me into it. I got into some cloud mining. So I didn't ever shitcoin, but I did get into the cloud mining. And that worked out okay, but not anywhere near as good as if I just used that money to buy Bitcoin. Mm. And then, it's funny. I just sort of get more and more interested and it gradually consumes you more and more. And it was 2019. I got to the point of just being all in.
Mm.
Couldn't think of holding anything else really. That's been the journey.
It's funny how it just seems to happen, doesn't it? Gradually, slowly but surely. And then until eventually it's just an obsession. Learning about it, reading, listening, watching things. And it does completely kind of, well, in my case as well, grab my attention. Like I can't think about anything else. And over the years, I've been invested in a number of different assets. None of them, I don't want to own any of them. Like, what's the point? There's literally no need. You now have this incredible savings technology in a sense. So in terms of asymmetric bets, like, can you just explain a little further as to what that really means when you're looking at making an investment and some examples perhaps of others that you might have seen previously and how they compare to what Bitcoin is?
Yeah, so what I mean by asymmetric is that the downside is far less than the upside. So you might say, my downside, like, let's say I can lose all my money. If I buy an option, I can lose all my money. The option can go to zero. But if certain scenarios happen, that option could be worth 10 times, 100 times the premium that you paid for it. So that's a way of capping your risk where your losses are limited, but there's a lot of profit potential there. And options would be the other main one that you would think about when you think about asymmetric bets. So that's when you're buying options. So if you're buying a call option, if the price of that underlying instrument that you bought the option on, if that rises significantly, you get a very outsized kind of increase in the value of the option. The big difference with Bitcoin, if you buy an option, you have what's called a carry cost. So there's a component of the option price that you pay that will decay with time. And options expire. The option at that point in time, that the time value of it on the final day will be zero. It reduces to zero. So if your event hasn't happened within that time window, go out and buy another option if you still expect the event to happen. The difference with Bitcoin is you have very, very limited carrying costs. So it doesn't decay like that. Now, yes, you'll need to invest a bit of money in your storage solutions and so forth. But that's a very tiny, tiny percentage of the value of the Bitcoin that you can hold. So yeah, that sort of time decay with options, I think that is where Bitcoin can really distinguish itself. And someone like Greg Foss has made this point quite well, that you've got this asymmetric bet, but with zero carry cost. We've never had that.
And to the average person on the street, talking about options and carry costs, etc., doesn't resonate per se. But to hear people like Greg Foss, who are from esteemed backgrounds, essentially talking about it in this sense, it's just yet another lens that we can look at this asset through and go, whoa, okay, that's bloody interesting. So basically every options trader out there should really be looking at Bitcoin rather than any of the options they were looking at before, because of the nature of the characteristics of the investment. The other thing it kind of calls to mind as a carry cost is when I think about some of the physical real estate investing I've done, it's not an asymmetric bet per se, but there is costs involved, right? So you've got agents to pay, you've got potential maintenance, you've got income tax, you might have mortgage or debt costs. These are all, in the same sense, like costs that you have to keep up whilst you own said asset for the upside that you're hoping to gain. Whereas Bitcoin hasn't got any. right? I mean, in comparison, the OPEX is minimal. Yes, you might pay an exchange to actually buy some or someone to help you self-custody, etc. But still, it's very minimal work with then an extraordinary potential upside when you look at the growth rate of adoption and all these kind of things that are actually quite important metrics on the value that's being created. And that perhaps applies to lots and lots of different investments you could make, that the cost of owning something, you just take that as part of the risk of the upside you're hoping to get. And this just turns it on its head completely. Wow. Okay. And so to circle back around, so Fast Bitcoins, Freehold Capital, can you talk a bit about those businesses? So what do they do? Who are the customers? What kind of traction have you had so far? What are you guys really excited about for the future?
Yeah, Fast Bitcoins was created by Danny and a couple of other co-founders in 2018. And the idea was to provide a platform that was relatively simple for newer people coming in to Bitcoin. So the mission is to build 1 billion Bitcoiners. And the way that we're doing that is just through having a clear, simple website. We're not like an exchange that has an order book. We just have a simple buy price. So people can just use that to start investing in Bitcoin. They can put in as much or as little as they want. And we also require our customers to withdraw their coins to their own custody. So that we think is a fundamental part of Bitcoin, and it's part of our business model. And it's been doing well. Yeah, we've certainly been growing quite a bit in some of the South American countries in the last 6 months or so. And it's interesting with the citizens down there, you don't have to do a lot of explaining as to why a fixed money supply is a useful thing, because they've grown up with inflation. I think inflation something like 50% per annum, price inflation, that is, wow, in Argentina at the moment. So they just kind of get it. And so those markets, they're less wealthy per capita than, say, Australia and the UK and the US, but there's a lot of people. So there's a lot of people to help. So that's been going well. We're excited at the moment. We've got an app that's going to be launching soon, in the next couple of months, and the development on that's going really well. So that'll be a nice user interface for customers. And we're also working on Visa debit cards. So you'll have a balance with us, a credit with us. And whenever you spend with this Visa debit card, and you can spend it wherever you can use Visa, so it's basically all around the world, you can auto convert a sats balance back to pay that fiat currency amount at your local supermarket or wherever you are. So we think that'll be great for adoption too, because it'll help people to be actively using Bitcoin and being able to save a lot more in Bitcoin and just use that for their expenses. So yeah, that's a couple of initiatives that we've got going. In terms of Freehold Capital, the idea, as I said, with that business is very much education-led and for people who want to spend time learning about Bitcoin and just need their hands held a bit more than perhaps some people might. And that typically the demographic we've seen is baby boomers, people in their 50s, perhaps sort of from a gold background or other, you know, successful business background that are looking to get into Bitcoin. So it's a bit scary because the amounts that they're looking to put in are quite significant. So in terms of how do they approach custody, you know, we do have a third-party custody solution that we can offer people. We're always encouraging people to hold their own keys. And interestingly, with the recent Taproot upgrade to the Bitcoin protocol, there's a way of using multi-signature that would be quite helpful for this kind of demographic. So let's say you've got a multi-signature wallet. It's a 2 of 3. And the client has 2 of the keys and we hold the third. So the client's in control while it's a 2 of 3. But after a certain time period, certain number of blocks, that wallet can degrade down to a 1 of 3. So the idea was to go and contact the client, say 6 months before that time period ends, just to confirm they've still got the keys, everything okay. If there's a problem and they've lost the keys, or maybe someone's passed away and hasn't properly informed their heirs of how to access those keys, Then we've got that one key that will get them out of jail. We can sweep those funds to a new wallet and they can set up again from there.
Wow. Awesome. I love, I'm completely enamored by entrepreneurs working with Bitcoin. So not just this incredible asset that the average person can store their wealth in, it's what's been built on it, around it, and what does the future look like? To draw back to the South American customers you were describing and the growth that you're seeing there, this is a dumbed down question in a sense, but it's clear to me product market fit is being achieved in places where the financial services are worst. So here in Australia, or where I grew up in the UK, credit cards, debit cards, mortgages, you know, it doesn't matter. You can function very easily. You know, small kids have bank accounts. That's not the case all around the world. So can you just talk to me a bit about the profile of the people that are most enjoying your services and the growth areas of South America and why they like it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much just your average pleb. And they very much see that need for a savings protocol where their money can't be eroded away from them. So we've had stories of people who remember as children having to, when their father was paid, getting to the grocery store as soon as possible, because those prices would be changing every day, or they might even be changing during the day. The stickers on the price stickers on the items would be changing. So yeah, it's just ordinary people. And yeah, like you said, they don't have the privilege and the luxury that we've had of having a reasonably stable financial system. So, you know, you've had families, I think even Wences Casares may have talked about having his family's wealth wiped out 3 times through hyperinflation in Argentina growing up. So again, there's this debate. People say, oh, Bitcoin is for criminals and it's boiling the oceans and all these stupid things. And they neglect the human rights aspects and the great benefits that it brings to just your ordinary people in some of these poor countries, just trying to, you know, go about their lives and raise their families and so forth, and the devastating effect that these inflations have on their savings and, you know, their experience of life.
So, and touching on what you mentioned earlier about inflationary events aren't necessarily bailed out by the taxpayer when the banking system collapses on itself. It's every citizen, and generally speaking, those without assets and using the cash economy suffer the most, right? It's so interesting to hear. And so just from a more technical point, so if I'm in South America, I'm in a country that suffered from inflation previously, and I start using Bitcoin, I use fast Bitcoins to purchase Bitcoin, I then self-custody it. The Visa and debit card that you guys are going to bring out, will that somehow be connected to the self-custody wallet, or would you have to have that in a more custody solution that you guys control? And I know that El Salvador has taken the lead here and Bitcoin is considered legal tender, so there's no capital gains implications, etc. But does that apply to most of these South American countries that you're talking about? Because to my knowledge, a lot of regulation hasn't really caught up to this, but perhaps they're in places where regulation just frankly doesn't matter.
We are coming out with our own wallet as well, something else to mention. So that'll be a very easy interface between our services and the self-custody for our customers. But you're right, like if we do come out of these cards, and people need a balance on them. So yeah, there'll be an element of custody there that we would need to do as they're sort of spent and replaced. The capital gains tax is a good one. Yes, in theory, you would be paying capital gains on those transactions. So in terms of how we'll manage that, we'll just have a statement at the end of the year for a customer with all of their transactions and then just a summary of what their capital gain or loss was.
Yeah.
And that's pretty easy to do.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds straightforward. Because it just, yeah. There's so many question marks over a new type of money. How does it work? What does it mean? How do I make sure that I'm not breaking the law? How does it actually function in the real world? And you touch on something great, which is so true. All these naysayers out there that are, you know, Bitcoin's terrible for the environment, or Bitcoin has no value. There's any number of different criticisms that frankly we should take head on, answer, you know, and continue to answer. But telling stories like this where people are genuinely using it because it's better than the system that they were born with, how can you possibly say that it's not creating any value? Like, that's probably a story that we'll hear for the next 10 years, right? Is that where you see the biggest kind of growth area then going forwards, is more and more people adopting Bitcoin and using it with very basic financial services attached, a debit card? I mean, you think that's already in existence, but of course it isn't. So we've got to build these things as entrepreneurs. Go out there. What do you need? Okay, cool. We'll build it. Is that the most exciting part of your business moving forwards, do you think? Or where do you see the biggest areas for growth?
Yeah, it is. And I think we've been relatively opportunistic in some of the markets that we've gone into. And it's good because it gives us a global perspective. So rather than just being an exchange that operates, you know, just in the UK or just in Australia or just in America, we do get to see the different sort of regulatory approaches and what is important to different markets. So yeah, I think it is really exciting. And then you look at other places like India, you know, there's a billion people there under financial repression. You know, they get taxed on their gold purchases.
Yeah, like a certain note gets taken out of circulation or whatever it was, the 1,000 rupee note or whatever it was. What even was it?
Yeah.
Those don't exist overnight, and then suddenly people are trading them at discounts, and they've lost. I mean, it's just nuts.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of good stuff we can do. We've also got our license to start operating in America, so we'll be doing that hopefully within the next 12 months or so. But yeah, like, it all excites me. I'm happy to help out a wealthy ex banker if they're interested in Bitcoin, or you know, just an average person from Argentina or India or Australia or anywhere. I think if someone's genuinely interested in Bitcoin, that's what excites me, no matter who they are.
Mm. That's kind of almost like an educational thing, like bringing people along on the journey. Wow. Okay. Yeah, cool. And that's a nice segue into what I was going to ask next, which is really like, having fallen down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, like, how do you feel? Like, how do you feel on a day-to-day basis? And you know, if you think back to maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago, and the kind of the day-to-day stresses you may have had with your wife around daily life, or whatever would have consumed your kind of anxiety, shall we say, has that changed? And what do you think are the biggest benefits of this process that you've learned?
Yeah, looking back, I always had a bit of a sense, even the years at Macquarie, that the system was kind of built on sand and was always vulnerable to a rug pull. But never quite, you know, all the stuff that you were doing, you're sort of in and you're out quickly, you're laying off the risks to someone else and trying to, you know, capture your slice of a transaction. There wasn't a hell of a lot of kind of long-term ownership mentality. That's very much the investment banking game. So I kind of felt that there was that sort of uncertain substructure. And then, of course, that was laid bare beautifully in 2008 and 2009 when the whole system came down. So really, since that time, I guess I've been asking questions, you know, and just had that sort of desire to try and figure out, like, how could this have happened? Like, the smartest guys in the room had no idea this was coming, no idea really what to do about it, and no idea where it was going at the time. So why is that? Mm-hmm. That led me down a rabbit hole of Austrian economics in 2014. So I started with Karl Menger's book, and I read Bomberwerk, and then I read Human Action by Mises. And that just really opened my eyes, because it just laid out so clearly and logically why the financial system was as fragile as it is. So I think, yeah, go back 5 to 10 years, I mean, say 5 years ago, I would have been thinking about these issues a lot and had different methods of trying to deal with it and protect savings. As Bitcoin's come along, like, it's just become really obvious to me that is the way solution. To go. Mm. Yeah, that's the best solution, yeah.
And so Austrian economics is something that, I mean, I went to a business school, did a business degree, Leeds University Business School back in the UK. And it was like a sub note in one lecture about economic history. and that was it in 3 or 4 years or whatever it was. And it's obviously now something that I'm only really starting to dig into. And I recently read some similar authors to what you mentioned, but can you give us a high level summary as to like what it teaches you? So when you start reading Austrian economics, like what is the main impact it has on how you view the world?
Yeah, I could never do it justice, really. I suppose it builds things up from first principles. And at the core of that is that humans make their own decisions and their own choices, and market interventions into that are going to distort the structure of production, are going to distort the choices that people make, and every intervention is going to lead to a suboptimal outcome compared to if fully free markets were able to operate. And we don't have anything like capitalism or free markets in our world today. Every industry is so regulated, and then bigger businesses are able to access capital markets for far cheaper costs of funds than smaller businesses. In Australia, the housing market is incredibly distorted by the incentives that are given there, including that the Reserve Bank of Australia prints billions of dollars a week to prop up the banks that make the mortgages, and that all flows through. So, yeah, this idea of, capitalism has failed, or, there are problems with capital. We don't have anything like free markets, anything like capitalism. And I think Austrian economics really helps to lay out to lay out what could be in our world, how that would be better, and really the consequences of all of this intervention. And another point perhaps worth mentioning as well is we hear a lot about intrinsic value. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value. Well, Austrian economics shows very nicely that all value is subjective. All value is subjective, and it's subjective between different people, and it's subjective between the same person at different times. So I've got a glass of water on my desk here. It's probably not worth much to me, but if I'd been in the desert for 10 days and hadn't had any water or food, a glass of water would be very, very valuable to me. And that just illustrates, the subjective value of things. And people are best positioned to make their own decisions for themselves and their families, rather than having a small number of politicians and bureaucrats determine what's in the best interests of everyone. So we have a highly distorted world, and I think Austrian economics really sets that out nicely. So certainly, the scales fall from your eyes, I suppose, which is a good and a bad thing. But ultimately, I'm very glad that I've got the knowledge.
It's a rabbit hole that I look forward to diving down even further. I feel like I've only just kind of scratched the surface. And that whole process of what's going on, this doesn't make much sense. And I mean, you had as good a view as you could have got, basically, for the 2008, 2009 crisis. And so somewhere deep down, you kind of knew it was going to happen. And then boom, like you physically saw it actually happen. You were probably in, Canary Wharf in London watching it fucking happen. I mean, where's the Macquarie offices in London? Are they in the East End or in?
In the city.
In the city. Okay, so you're in the Square Mile and there's financial Armageddon. And you, in a weird way, kind of knew it might happen, and here it is. And this is then kind of like searching process that we seem to go through. There are characters that are very inquisitive, and you go, well, hang on, that doesn't make sense. Why doesn't that make sense? And before you know it, you're reading kind of niche Austrian economics books. And the fact is, they shouldn't be niche. They should have been in my business degree. They should have been things that we were taught many, many years ago, yet we weren't. Now, we could get conspiratorial for a second and go, well, why aren't we taught these things? And perhaps that's because the system's set up in a way to profit for a bunch of characters that definitely don't want it changing. Who knows? Yes. Dot, dot, dot.
Completely agree.
And it's that funny thing when actually like along comes Bitcoin, you think, wow, okay, this actually starts to tick a lot of boxes. My personal view has always been, how to store wealth long term. And it's incredibly hard. All these assets that you're investing in have risk. Things can go wrong. You're not guaranteed returns, and you can't just save your cash. There's no way of doing it. So suddenly along it comes, you go, well, hang on, this is a game changer to the problem that I faced before. But yeah, okay, let's humor this. Let's get a little conspiratorial for a second. So recently we were at the Bitcoin Bush Bash together and you gave a presentation about the Great Reset. Let's dive into that for a second. So when was that a term that first came across your radar? Why is it important to basically all of us? And what do we do about it?
Yeah, it's probably a couple of years ago, I think I might have first heard the term. And Bitcoiners have been right onto this. So none of it is conspiratorial because it's all published on the World Economic Forum's website. So they're very open. I mean, the fellow, our boy Klaus, he actually...
Oh boy, he actually looks like a Bond villain, doesn't he? I mean, you couldn't...
Oh, it's beautiful.
You couldn't ask for a better caricature if you wanted, right?
Yeah, yeah. So he wrote a book called The Great Reset.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
No, it's something else was like, you should read that, Jake. It's actually a good point. It's probably one to sit down and read and see what he actually says. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've got, as a Bitcoiner, you know, you've got to kind of manage what you read. I bumped into another Bitcoiner at the Bush Bash, awesome fellow. And he was telling me that he read Robert Kennedy's book on.
The real Anthony Fauci. Brilliant. Yeah.
And he said, I just came out of it feeling so angry. But yeah, mate, you know the guy's a devil. You don't need to read a book about it. So I think you do need to, as a Bitcoiner, manage some of the material you take in.
Interesting.
Sometimes, because it can get a bit all-consuming and, you know, you just end up wanting to light things on fire or whatever. So it just takes some patience. But yeah, so Klaus Schwab and you know, the Great Reset, the World Economic Forum, they've boasted about penetrating the cabinets of many Western countries, including Australia and Canada. We had a Senate inquiry into cryptocurrencies recently here in Australia, and the fellow that was heading that up is a member of the Young Global Leaders, which is part of the World Economic Forum. So they've definitely got their fingers into a lot of pies. These people, they seem to be pushing an agenda to reset capitalism. It hasn't worked. God knows, I mean, as far as I can tell, it's just an excuse or a method to institute global communism, where a very small number of people will benefit. They will own everything, and the rest of us will own nothing, and we're told we'll be happy. Now, that is my idea of hell on earth. So it's interesting just to watch these things. They're all out in the open, and to just try to resist them as best you can. And, you know, I think Bitcoin is probably the single greatest tool that we have to do that. So the more that we can educate people on Bitcoin, help adoption, make sure people hold their own keys, because otherwise it doesn't work. And hopefully bit by bit, Bitcoiners will gain in power, and these people, these globalist people will lose their power, you know, relative to what they have at the moment.
It's a very real threat. I think that that's almost a really important juncture to get to. And it took me some time as well. I mean, my wife was well ahead of me in terms of, certainly some of the reactions to the global pandemic that we've seen, and the only route out being a pre-described medication that hasn't even finished trials. And if you don't do it, you haven't got your job. And if you don't do it, you can't travel. And if you don't do it, then you're completely and utterly, you know, cast aside in society. Whoa, like, where did that come from? Like, bang, out of nowhere. And you can start reading about these organizations, right? It's got a website, it's got a book. It's like, hang on, this is literally out in the open. I have recently finished The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is an incredible read that... If it does nothing other than gets you to ask questions, it's done its job. Like, what is the IMF? What is the World Bank? Hang on. So, and Macquarie, infrastructure investors, they probably were involved in a whole ton of projects that were very similar to this, where it's like centrally planned, huge budget, and it fails. But they don't care because they've just been paid a shitload in interest on the debt that they issued. And, oh, it's going to fail. Don't worry, we'll reissue some more debt because, oh, we control the money printer. And suddenly you go, hang on. So there's literally people out there that can make money from money that they create. That's what? you know what I mean? And even someone like myself who spent 10, 15 years studying business, wanting to make money, trying to run companies, come from a family business, always taught to look at like, you know, how it was functioning, et cetera. And I'd never, ever, ever understood that fact. And it changes your view completely because you go, hang on, this doesn't make sense. And then suddenly there's this neutral monetary network that you can adopt. And I love your emphasis on self-custody. So important, because I see entrepreneurs out there, you know, a service I really like is Celsius Network and the yield products that they've got. And they are adamant that, you know, to get the next billion people into crypto, as they call it, they need to provide a kind of new service of custody, essentially, because people will never self-custody their own digital assets. And to a point, I completely see that use case because it makes it easier for people to adopt their new technology and new service and benefit from their products and the yield they create. But on the other side, it just completely misses the point, which is owning the keys to your wealth that no one else can touch is an unbelievably profound innovation that is undervalued today. Oh, I don't want to learn about owning my own keys. Why? It means you haven't understood the importance of keeping what's yours away from places where it can be taken. And you can see this time and time again where semi-centralized or centralized services get corrupted at the top of the pile. And someone suddenly goes, oh yeah, throw the doors open to WEF or, you know, a government of some form. And maybe people need to get burnt, right? They need to go and have their stuff taken off them. Like if you're an RG that's had, you know, three rounds of inflationary events through their lifetime and their family's lost everything three times, they're going to hold their own keys. Whereas someone who hasn't perhaps had the same pain won't. How interesting. And so just vibing off this great reset and global communism, like where have you seen that impact in, let's take Australia as an example. Like, is that obvious today in areas that you didn't notice it before? And have you seen it start popping up in ways that you didn't previously recognize? Or how's it actually manifesting itself?
Yeah, well, it's been a hell of a couple of years down here, hasn't it, Jake?
Mm, yeah.
You arrived, was it December 2019, just in time for the festivities?
December the 31st, 2019, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think you're right in what you described before in terms of you grow up being told that you live in a free country. And then you know, there are certain sort of rule of law, constitutional protections and so forth. And then, you know, we have an emergency, a so-called emergency. And it all just gets thrown out the window. And the kind of tactics that the government and the police were using on the citizens of Victoria, it was just incredible to watch. And yeah, even now, as you say, many people have been forced into taking these injections. It's been very hard to resist. It's been very hard for a lot of people to resist. Mm. That idea that you've got some sort of ability to give consent to a medical procedure, like if you don't, if you don't get to say what goes in your own body, like if you don't own your own body, what do you own at all?
What do you own
in the world? Yeah. In life? Yeah.
You'll own nothing. You'll be happy.
Yeah, apparently so. Not even your own body.
Yeah.
So it's been amazing, mate. But like, I feel like it's getting a bit easier now. People are getting over it.
Correct. Know, yeah.
Had enough of the rubbish that we've seen. So yeah, I hope they don't do all the lockdowns again this winter.
Yeah, that was miserable.
Some part of me thinks that it's possible. But yeah, hopefully people are ready to push back enough.
Well, it's definitely possible in that there's a law in place where a permanent state of emergency now exists in the state of Victoria, Australia. And that law, you know, was being protested very heavily just before Christmas, and yet still they pushed it through. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of people on the street. You couldn't ask for a more popular reaction to, guys, we don't like what you're doing to where we live. And yet still they did it. Like the arrogance of it's extraordinary. Like it really is. It's like, we don't care about any of you. Very simple. And the exciting part is here we are talking about Bitcoin. Fuck yeah. We can build another society. We can build a different monetary system where, you know, I love this concept of a meritocracy in that you might own more Bitcoin than anyone else in the world, but you can't print more of it. So you can't change the system. You can't change the rules. And, you know, if you go out and, you know, you apply yourself, you learn a skill, you generate an income, you can then actually save that in a place that is appreciating over time, you're rewarded for your hard work. And it just changes everything. And as soon as you get that, you know, because, like, rest assured, like, private jets were flying in and out of Australia and they weren't have been vaccinated. They were doing what the fuck they wanted because they were rich.
Sovereign individuals.
And in that sense, they played out that thesis. So in some senses, it's very, very exciting where we're at today. And, you know, the tendencies of Daniel Andrews that I've only ever witnessed from a distance through a TV. I've never met the guy. I've never spoken to him. I have no idea who he is. But they were extraordinarily authoritarian. And he had no problems whatsoever trampling over democracy, trampling over transparency. Like, he still hasn't told anyone what science is being used to give health advice. And you're like, what? How is that a transparent democracy? Like, it's an absolute joke is what it is.
Yeah,
and you get people, you know, singing this national anthem at the AFL with thousands of people in there and talking about being young and free. And you're just like, this is a joke. This is an absolute joke.
It's an absolute joke.
So once the veil kind of falls down a bit, you go, well, hang on, what is going on here and what can I do about it? And that's where, you know, I love these stories, right? People like yourself who've got this incredible you know, caliber and background in financial services and then a bit of entrepreneurship have adopted this new technology with the belief that it's going to build a better future. Why? Why have you done that? And you've explained, obviously, a lot of the reasons. No, it's fantastic. Well, so Nathan, an hour has flown by. Last comments. If there's anything else you want to add, then please jump in. But equally, you know, where can people find you if they want to find out more about what you're working on?
Yeah, so two websites I'll leave you with is fastbitcoins.com and freehold.capital. Go and check those out if you want to. But yeah, great discussion, Jake. And after your superstar first guest in the Knut's Fun Home, I was very honored to see that you.
Yeah, no, well done.
Interviewing some of we plebs, so really appreciate
it. Yeah, and I had a good chat with Daz B as well last night. So I'm going to make a real effort to, just on a personal level, follow account doesn't matter. Stories do. And that's what I'm most interested in, is how have people come to realize what they realize and why are they doing this? And I think that through telling these stories, this is primary research at its best, right? I'm literally talking to people. It's going to help others understand why it's important and what they might be able to do. And in a sense, it is preaching. You know, people talk about religion, don't they? And, like, you know, going out there and spreading the gospel. And in some senses, that's exactly what this is. But fuck it. I think it's definitely a brighter future than some other visions that people, you know, aim for. I mean, to mention Daniel Andrews again, his future vision of Victoria is not a place I want to live. Like, no thanks, mate. You've removed my autonomy to do anything I want. So no interest. On that truth bomb. Thanks, Nathan, for your time. Really appreciate it. And we'll catch up soon.
Pleasure, Jake. Thank you.